Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the American dream? And can it really be called that if its fulfillment is impossible even for Americans trying their best to get ahead? Last month, Dallas Theater Center hosted the world premiere of a new musical called Stagger Lee. The production, which is ongoing, draws on the told and retold Frankie and Johnny and Long Lost John tales and the legend that has grown up around the case of a man named Lee Stagg Shelton, who was jailed for murder in 1895 after shooting a friend in a gambling dispute. These stories are playwright and lyricist Will Powers' springboard for chronicling the experiences of Black Americans in the 20th century and for exploring the role of myth in America's understanding of itself. Stagger Lee continues at Dallas Theater Center through this Sunday, February 15th, and you can check out Jerome Weeks' special multimedia exploration of the show and its development called Stagger Lee, Making a Musical at artandseek.org/staggerlee. Will Power is here now to talk to us about all of this. Will, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yep.
So you developed this interest in Greek mythology, and then you started asking about whether there is American mythology.
That's right. That's right. And it's really fascinating because I feel there are so many different kinds of people, so many different kinds of culture in America. And so I started thinking, do we have one mythology that kind of bonds us? Because, you know, the Greeks, there were different kinds of Greeks, but they all were there for a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they had this common understanding that they can then debate and argue. And you could do your version of Oedipus. I could do my version. But when we're all coming with from such vastly different perspectives, how do we do that? And it's also one of the beautiful things about this country that we have these different kinds of cultures. It's what makes us so innovative, I feel. But it's also that kind of challenge culturally. So I started thinking about these old folk tales, and I thought that this was as close to mythology as we've gotten as Americans, you know what I mean? And perhaps it could eventually become a mythology. These old songs, Frankie and Johnny, Stagger Lee, Long Lost John, John Henry, which I was trying to figure out how to get John Henry in, but I couldn't.
The guy who beat the machinery,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's another one in this canon of mm-hmm. stories and songs. So these are all pieces that were based on real life events that then got blown out of proportion and got, you know, became myth, became epic. And then every generation, I would say, from the late 19th century through the 1970s, told their own version of these songs. So in the 20s, you can hear people like Mississippi John Hurt doing a blues version of Stagger Lee. When you get to the 50s, of course, it's Lloyd Price. In the early 70s, Bobby Seale of the Black Panther Party started calling himself Stagger Lee. You know, so they all had these different turns. And so it's it's just kind of my charge to try to resurrect it and try to look underneath it, kind of deconstruct the myth and kind of hopefully use it as a common language, a basic form of engagement that different people can have dialogue around.
Let's listen to a little bit of the Lloyd Price version for people who think, I know I've heard that name, but I'm not sure I remember the song.
Let's do it.
That is Lloyd Price, 1959 recording of Stagger Lee. What I've always loved about that song is how happy it sounds mm-hmm. and yet how very dark the subject is.
Right. Well, that's kind of like one of the things that's very complex about particularly African-American culture is that sometimes you'll have something that has some violence or has some brutality, but in it there's actually the strength of someone who won't take any crap, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Excuse me. And so with Stagger Lee, it's kind of like you're scared of him, but he also has a side that's the protector, that's the builder, you know? And for this piece, that's kind of what I want to look behind. The song, as you heard, is about two guys. Some accounts say they were friends, and they get into this fight, and one person kills another person. So that really made me feel like, well, if they were friends, why did one person kill another person? And what was really underneath? And for me, it's taking this kind of big boogeyman, like the kind of stereotype of like the big Black, you know, boogeyman, and going deeper and saying, what are the complexities of that stereotype/archetype? You know, and that's what it is to me, because in my neighborhood, the Stagalese were so much more complex than just someone walking down the street and, oh, we're scared of him. They were like these nuanced, complex figures.
What really struck me about this, because throughout the show, Stagalee, he's like, he's protector and he is he is a threat. He is someone who is sort of always menacing, and yet he's loyal to his friends or the people that he cares about. And those complexities would not be so apparent to, say, like white people in the situations with your characters who were to meet the character of Stagalee, but the black people who encounter him are able to kind of understand the full complexities of this character.
Right, because I think a lot of times those characters are understood in their full complexities within those cultures. You know what I mean? Now, if you look back at, I'm not an expert, but you look back in 1920s in Chicago at, you know, Al Capone, you know, or some figures that were, you know, gangsters, but they also, you know, passed out turkeys or whatever. Right. You know what I mean? Only the people within that culture would understand the complexities. To the outside world, he's like the gangster. You know, he's the bad guy. But to the inside world, that is true, but there's also another side to it, too. And I think for African-Americans, in trying to, you know, deal with and potentially overcome the obstacles of racism and prejudice, there's always been different ways to go about it. There've been people who've said, okay, I'm going to put on a suit and tie and I'm going to glide over it. I'm going to dance over this. You know what I mean? I'm going to outclass this. Yeah. And then there's also been those who've been like, I'm going to roll up my sleeves. I'm going to pound it with my fists. And so this piece, Stagalee, you have Stagalee, but you also have the character Billy. And they're both builders in some ways, but Billy is like, I'm going to build it on the up and up. I'm going to build it legitimately. I believe in the American dream, and I'm going to build it that way. And Stagalee, very early on in life, has been deterred from the American dream. He said, no, I'm going to survive. I'm going to overcome and being, you know what I mean? I'm going to put on this coat, this energy, this powerful energy of resistance, and do it that way. And so I feel like that's always been in the African-American community, these different kinds of ways to respond. Yeah.
It's interesting throughout the show because we're, of course, rooting for Billy. It's sort of easy to like him and to relate to him. And we can't quite decide if we want him to keep doing the right thing that doesn't seem to be working, or
talking about Billy now.
Yeah, talking about Billy, or to lash out. It's hard to know.
Right, right. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, and it's also about theater. Like, obviously, we want to root for the hero, and we should root for the hero, but we got to put the hero through some obstacles, right? Because then it's not interesting. So I've even got some people saying, like, you know, why do you get so bleak in some parts? And it's not like, it's not, it's just like, you know, how do you really test a character and also a people's and also a person's, you know, inner sides? How do you test that? And you test it by putting them through a lot of obstacles. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's easy for us to be a hero and believe in the American dream when things are easy, but when things are really pressed upon the character. And so I really wanted Billy to go through a lot of stuff because, quite frankly, African Americans have been through a lot of stuff. I feel the piece is a celebration. I don't look at the piece as a tragedy. I don't look at it that way. Personally, you know, I feel
there's a lot of tragedy in it, though.
There is a lot of tragic things in it, definitely. But I don't want to give away the ending. But I feel like also in the piece, in my opinion, there's tremendous humor. There's joy. You know what I mean? There's dancing. And I think it's people trying to live and trying to strive. And so, you know, I did not want to have it be so sad. But at the same time, I want to acknowledge some of the things, you know, because the piece moves through time. So I want to acknowledge some of the things that African Americans have gone through as a culture. And I wanted to explore the different ways that we have tried to meet those challenges.
Seeing this production and then doing some reading for a completely unrelated show that we have coming up next week, it occurred to me that in America, we sort of deny the idea that we have mythologized anything. You know what I mean? Like, we think we know the facts of the American Revolution and of the Civil War and of, you know, Manifest Destiny or something. We think we understand the facts, and we don't really acknowledge the fact that there is mythology to everything about the way we understand our history.
Absolutely. And for me, and this may be because I'm an artist, you know, and I might have a skewed view of it, but to me, oftentimes mythology actually has more truth than fact. I mean, some people would deny that, but, you know, mythology A mythological figure is someone who is part fact and part fiction to get to a deeper truth. And I was trying to explain this to my son the other day, and he was like, I don't get it. And I was like, well, if someone is walking down the street and they're really huge and they're kind of a menacing figure, you might say, you know, Jeff walked down the street and he was so large and menacing that he blacked out the sun. Now, of course, he actually didn't black out the sun. But if you say this guy was walking down the street and he was a large and menacing figure, that might not get to the crux, the truth of how powerful and or menacing and how scary this person was, you know? So I feel like facts, there are some things we like to think that are facts, factual forever, but facts change. I mean, in 1450 in Europe, the world was flat. That was a fact, you know? 100 years later, that changed, but there's certain truths that I think are deeper than facts, I think. So that's what I'm into, you know, and with these mythological figures, you know, Stagger Lee takes on mythological proportions. He's a man, but he's also a person that takes on this energy of this resistance that has been alive in the African-American community and also, quite frankly, all communities, immigrant communities that have come over and have met with resistance. You know, they've had to pull on that Stagger Lee to survive. Then the trick is when some of them become assimilated, how do you negotiate that Stagger Lee after you move into the suburbs, you know, and move into those things? So that's also part of what the piece is about.
I love the conceit that your four protagonists, aside from Stagger Lee, sort of stay the same or are in very similar situations, and time and space moves around them. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it would sound like it would be confusing. It works beautifully, and it really reinforces the idea of things like multi-generational poverty and racism and the things that every time we hope that we've fixed them, we realize they're still an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. When we were initially developing this, I initially put the whole thing in 1895 in St. Louis. I only had about 20 minutes. I wrote four songs and about 20 minutes of material. And so we were in St. Louis. And my idea was that I was going to always stay in that moment. And then my co-composer, Justin Ellington, who's also the orchestrator, who's done just amazing work on the music, had this idea, what if it moved through time? And my jaw just dropped. We were right there in the hotel, you know, working somewhere out in the East Coast. I was like, oh, that's it, you know. And then I added, what if it also moves to different places? Mm-hmm. Because this piece, kind of as you referenced in the introduction, is about, you know, African-American migration and search for the American dream. And so some people migrated up the East Coast to New York, and some migrated from Mississippi up to Chicago, and some, like my grandmother, migrated out west. And so there was these different migratory patterns. And so I thought about keeping the narrative arc and the conflicts within the characters that progresses so we don't go back. But then you have these huge leaps. And as you have these leaps, whatever was going on socially and politically for African-Americans and in the culture and in the country influences the personal narrative arc, you know? So you do get this idea of nothing changes, but nothing stays the same. You do get this generational link. And I really was able to explore the myths of Stagger Lee and Frankie and Johnny in, I think, a more profound way that I wouldn't have been able to if I would have just kept them in one time period. This idea of the 50s of we're going to get a better life, we're going to move out to the suburbs, a la Raising in the Sun, for example, and then this idea of what happens when, you know, those people leave the neighborhood and people leave the neighborhood and the resources are pulled out and the projects are built up and what happens in Oakland in the 1970s, you know, what happens in the, and so just exploring that gives it a more dynamic breath. And also the music, because in every era, the music is different. So we have all these different musical and physical styles that we can play with when exploring Stagger Lee.
We're speaking with playwright and performer Will Power. He wrote the book and lyrics for the musical Stagger Lee. It continues at Dallas Theater Center through Sunday, February 15th. You can also see Stagger Lee making a musical. That's a special multimedia presentation by Jerome Weeks at artandseek.org/Stagger Lee. We'll resume the conversation in a minute. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Bye.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
That is the cast of Stagger Lee singing about St. Louis in the musical Stagger Lee. We're speaking this hour with playwright Will Power. And you can see Stagger Lee at the Dallas Theater Center through this Sunday, February 15th. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You know, Will, it starts out so exciting and we're so happy about these people getting to St. Louis that we almost want to forget that, things were, for many people, not substantively better in the North than they had been in the South.
Exactly. At the point in St. Louis, which is the big opening number, as you referenced, they don't really know that yet. So they're leaving the South and they're leaving a lot of problems. You know, Jim Crow, you know, Reconstruction had been pulled back. Just massive lynching, just a lot of drama. And so their hope is this idealized version of the North. Now, there are a lot of opportunities in the North. I think about my own family. You know, my mother's side came up from Virginia. My father's side is from Louisiana, coming up through the West. So there were opportunities, but of course, oftentimes it's not how we would think. And there's tremendous pushback in the North, not in the way that it is in the South, but tremendous racism, tremendous obstacles that they have to face and try to overcome.
And with that great migration and the diaspora, a lot of people, at least temporarily, felt they had lost their communities, the people that they were used to seeing. You know, there are references in the show to, like, we can't see our friends at church and that sort of thing.
Well, that's the other thing. That's the thing that African Americans and really every group that's immigrated here has had to really consider. Okay, we're going to leave and go to New York, to the United States for this better life that we envision. But what is the trade-off? You know, when you're leaving your native country or your native land or where you're from, yeah, you're leaving a lot of family, leaving a lot of friends, you're leaving traditions, you're leaving customs, you're leaving a lot. And there were a lot of people that were like, no, we're going to try to make it here in the South. Or, you know, again, opening up, no, we're going to stay in Ireland, we're going to stay in Italy, we're not going to leave. So that was a really, really hard thing. Just things like the weather. Now, not that it doesn't get cold here, in, you know, Dallas or Houston or Louisiana. But you got to remember, they're coming up. A lot of them were sharecroppers. They didn't have a lot. And they're moving to Chicago. They're moving to Detroit. They're moving to these cold places for the most part. And so even that is an adjustment. But they did what a lot of people have done when they've migrated. They've tried to find a community, try to huddle together, you know, and do the best they can and support one another.
I have to ask you about language, because there are a couple of scenes that remind us of truly hateful things that white Americans have done to black Americans over the course of history. One scene in particular, you do not put into the mouths of these very hateful, violent white people the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about why.
You know, it's interesting. I have used that word in about every other play of mine. You know what I mean? Because it's a word that's very loaded, and it's a word that is, the N-word is a word that's very unique in a lot of ways.
Like a slap in the face.
Yeah, it's really hard to capture that. Usually, like, you know, so it's always popped up. But for this piece, I tried on purposely to not include it. And I wanted to, I was kind of trying to do an experiment with myself. I wanted to see if I could get across the energy and the pain and the kind of violation of that word without actually using the word. And primarily that was also because I was trying to see if I could create more access to this piece. I've seen so many generations of people in the audience come to this piece. Mm-hmm. older people, like in their 80s, you know, people who are like, I remember that era. I remember that dance. That looks like my dress, you know, to people who are like 9 or 10 years old. And that was important to me because, like you said, because we moved through these different eras, because this is an exploration of an entire century of American history, I wanted to give access. And I thought that, you know, having the intensity of the era and not pulling any punches there, but also being mindful of the language would help give more access to the generations. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen that. And it seems like I haven't lost anything by not putting that in there. But you're right. There are a couple of places where they probably would have thrown that in there as opposed to, you know, Darkie or, you know, whatever else I use. But it was kind of like trying to explore that for myself as a writer. And it might be, quite frankly, you know, I'm a little older now. And I think when I'm, you know, when I was writing in my 20s, my teens and my 20s, part of the liberation is, yeah, I can curse, you know, I can throw these words around. That was part of it. As I got older and I have children, you know, it's like, how do I get the energy and the message and the beauty and also the brutality of what's going on in there without necessarily ostracizing people by using that language? There's some people who are like, I don't care if it's positive, blacks and whites, I'm not going to go if that word is there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a choice that all artists have to use. And that word may creep back into some other of my pieces. But for this, I really want to explore giving access to multiple generations.
Did you struggle with what substitute word to use? I mean, sadly, there are a litany of racist words that people have used against Black Americans.
That's really interesting. No, you know, I just had that idea in the back of my head that I was going to see if I could explore it that way. And then it just kind of came out naturally once I had that. It's kind of like when you set up the rules or the principles. Like, this is a musical. My last play, Fetch Clay, Make Man, was just, you know, we did it in New York and a number of places. It was a straight play. So obviously I'm not going to go into 5 songs. I mean, unless I want to change the form, you know, but this one is a musical. So same thing. I was like, okay, these are the parameters for this language. This is where I want to go to. And it seems like people still get the umph of it, you mm-hmm. know? But yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it brings up a more interesting question about that word, about, like, you know, a lot of young people use the N word. And it's the question of whether that's a holdover from the trauma and the oppression, or whether it's young people trying to empower themselves by exploding that word and using it as a term of endearment. It's kind of controversial. Does it make any sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think both maybe can be true at once.
It's controversial. It's controversial, you know. And then there's everyone. It's just a real interesting idea. Someone needs to write a book on that. Like, it's really interesting, you know, because now other cultures use that. That word amongst themselves. So is that disrespect on the deepest level of what African Americans have been through, or is it I empathize, you know, with you because I have my struggles as an Asian American? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a real sensitive thing. And ultimately, this piece is not about that word or that sensitivity, but I could have utilized it, but it's not about that. So that's the other thing. I didn't want to take away from the main story about what it is by people going out and talking about, I'm glad they used that. I'm glad they didn't use it. You know what I mean? I wanted to load it in a different way. And I think we were effective in that, I think. We'll see.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jane on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jane.
Hi, wonderful show and excellent, excellent play.
Thank you.
My husband and I saw it last week, and we were so deeply moved. We woke up the next morning with heavy, heavy, heavy hearts, really touched us so deeply. And the performances were just outstanding. Staggerly was tremendous. But I have a question for you. One comment and
sure.
One question. Comment is, you know, I went through a period in my life where I was one of those women, you know, in the welfare office. I mm-hmm. loved the song, and you know, it brought back all that. I was a single mom and definitely mm-hmm. went through that. But I was able to access scholarships and go to school and graduate school and put my husband through law school, and you know, and he got scholarships. And so with a little bit of opportunity,
mm-hmm.
you know, lives could be so tremendously changed. And that's what we were thinking about. With some opportunity, lives could be changed. And then the other thing I was wondering is this a tale that you confine to the Black community, or do you see it as an American sale that basically is encompassing the racism that we see for all people of color?
Mm-hmm. Those are some fantastic questions. I'll answer the second one first. I think my intention as the playwright and co-composer was to create a tale that is specific to African Americans, but at the same time could speak to the universal story of how various peoples have been oppressed and subjugated to inhumane treatment in the United States. Again, that could be Mexican Americans coming over. That could be, again, Italians and Irish and Jews at the turn of the century coming over through Ellis Island into New York. So I feel like it's kind of both. It's a tale about African Americans, but it also speaks to the general subjugation. I do feel like African Americans, for various reasons, have been through a particularly intense process in this country. And though a few have been able to kind of make it and attain this elusive American dream, I think that, as is indicative, unfortunately, of Ferguson and the things in New York and the things in Ohio, it still is still a real challenging road for African-Americans as a community, even in 2015. So I think it's both. It's a personal story and a universal story. To the first thing you said, yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, I think that there are those cases of people that have been able to somehow, through superhuman strength, rise out of the muck and all the challenges. And there are some opportunities that are open to African Americans and people of color that maybe weren't open necessarily 40 or 50 years ago. But I would say that, you know, that is usually still the exception and not the rule. In other words, you know, if there's someone who's exceptionally talented, quite frankly, either they're very smart or they're really great at painting or they're amazing at doing a doctor or they can throw a football, they can write a play, whatever, then sometime and they're lucky, they might be able to get out of that situation and attain the American dream. But the it's still very inequitable because in another community, like in a white community, the people who are exceptional get a hand up. But the people that are pretty good, they have an easier chance. So people that are just average, you know what I mean? There's people who might just, I'm just average. But that's where the inequity really happens, you know? So if someone is in that situation like the welfare office and they have exceptional talent and they get real lucky, they find a teacher or they find a counselor or something like that, then that can be possible. But the majority still struggle. And I really want to show that it wasn't just, you know, these mothers are lazy or these people are violent or something like that. It's really systematic problems that really put people in these difficult choices. Okay, do I feed my children and have my husband or my man emasculated and really play these roles? Or do I try to stand up for these principles and, you know, don't have any food in these situations where there's no jobs? And that is often the case. It's not always the case, but it's often the case.
Where does hope come from in those situations? Because that's the one thing your characters maintain pretty much throughout, even when things are very, very bleak.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I don't really know. I don't really know where hope comes from. I mean, I think in this piece, Delilah, she pulls hope and faith from the ancestors. She pulls it from her community. And the idea is that the individual affects the community with a little hope, and the community then affects the individual. You know what I mean? And then they pull it up. So it's in the play, but it's actually, that's pretty mysterious because I don't know. I mean, I've asked, you know, my mother, my father, my grandparents have gone through stuff. Where does it come from? And I think it just comes from that inner strength of, again, African Americans and of humanity. There's that inner, that deeper well that you don't know where it comes from, and you pull on it, you know what I mean, to get through something. Yeah, I don't know. It's a mysterious place, but it's there and exists, and we can access it as human beings, you know. And there's been a lot of stories of those kinds of people, like, how did you survive? How did you keep going? So that's kind of how I feel. And my ancestors, you know, as a black man, my ancestors, my elders have been through so much. Again, a lot of joy, a lot of good times, but also a lot of just challenges. And I feel like if they can overcome, then I, at the very least, can overcome, and we can overcome as hard as it is now, you know, yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Ron in Dallas. Hello, Ron.
Hi there. Thank you for letting me ask this question. Always a great show. I saw the play, and I was wondering why you decided to have an all-black cast. And let me just offer a little more context to that. There were a number of scenes where I believe that black players were playing white players, and it got a little confusing to me, like especially in the bathroom scene in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I thought that the well-to-do folks were just, you know, rich black people, and my friends thought that the well-to-do folks were rich white people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I circle back to why all black in the cast?
That's a great question, too. You know, it's interesting. I feel like, you know, we're still, that's still one thing I'm trying to clarify. Obviously, for this production, you know, it's done. But hopefully, God willing, if we get another production, we'll be able to clarify that even more. The idea is that this is the community, meaning the African-American community, telling a story. So it's as if you were at a dinner party and there were five people all from the same culture, and they were telling a story, and this story included people from other cultures. They would then, hopefully with some dignity and respect, inhabit other cultures, other characters from other cultures when they're relaying that story. So that was the idea. It's almost like when the play opens, you know, I don't want to give it away, but it's like the community comes out on stage and they sing this prologue, and then from that they tell all these stories. And it's something powerful to me about someone from another culture portraying another culture, that kind of thing. The other thing I would say is that, you know, to utilize five or six Caucasian actors, I think the white characters in the play, they come in at critical junctions, but they don't come in through the whole thing. You know what I mean? They're not like large roles. And so I feel like, you know, I have had white actors and white characters in some of my earlier works, but I really want to be able to utilize them and give them a lot of dimension and make it worth it, you know? So I would say that. And then the third thing, quite frankly, is employment. So even though we're not a Fortune 500 company here, we're able to employ 21 African-American actors, half from Dallas, half from New York. And if there's a way that I can bring that through, I want to do it, you know, because I feel like African-American actors, particularly in Dallas, from what I'm told, don't get as many opportunities, especially on stages like that. I mean, it's happening more now with Kevin, but anytime I can do that. So to allow them to employ African-American actors and then ask them to inhabit these roles to tell the full story was kind of the road we tried to go.
We're speaking this hour with playwright Will Power about Stagger Lee, which continues at Dallas Theater Center through Sunday, February 15th. You can see Stagger Lee making a musical online at artandseek.org/Stagger Lee. It's Jerome Weeks' piece that is a multimedia presentation of the development of the show. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
That, once again, is the cast of Stagger Lee, which is at the Dallas Theater Center through Sunday, February 15th. We have playwright and composer Will Power here. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Will, when you were writing this, did you think about your audience in terms of archetypes, or did you think about individuals, or did you just think, I want the world at large to come to this piece of work?
In the audience?
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. You know, usually most of my pieces, I do have an audience in mind. So, for example, when I did The Seven, which was the adaptation of the Greek play Seven Against Thebes, I thought about people who like hip hop and people who like the classics, mm-hmm. and how to bridge that gap. When I did my solo show Flow, that was really about my generation. So all ethnicities, but my generation. So we had it at me and the director, Danny Hawk, we had it at a certain pace. And some people were like, we love it, but slow it down. Some older people were like, no, you know, that kind of thing. This piece is interesting because while I was working on this, I was premiering another work that was, there was so much pressure on it to like get it to be on Broadway and that kind of stuff that this piece, I didn't really care. I was like, I just wanted to be open. You know what I mean? This is actually one piece that I didn't necessarily think about an audience. I mean, clearly the African-American community retelling our story so younger people can know into generations and have a conversation. Clearly, you know, idea of immigrants and the American dream and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's funny. This one, I didn't think about that as much. I just wanted people to understand the story. And I was so focused on that with another work that I didn't think about the audience as much. Interesting. Yeah.
Is this a piece at an unprecedented scale, even for you, based on the other things that you've written in the past?
This is definitely the biggest piece I've ever done. I mean, I've done things that I guess you could consider to be a musical, but they were more non-traditional musicals, hip-hop theater musicals, music with, you know, kind of edgy, artsy works.
Yeah.
Music heavily influenced in it, but not so much. This is definitely my first traditional music where we scored everything. Rick Fox, music director. We had people on the orchestrations. We had this guy, Brian, a copyist. He was just there like, I mean, this was a major, you know, major piece, full 8-piece band. We talked about the, you know, costumes. It's definitely my biggest work. And I think it's kind of part of my exploration. This was my thing of like, what would happen if I put myself into a traditional musical structure? The content is not traditional, but mm-hmm. the structure. And of course, it's going to change because I'm a different kind of cat.
Yeah.
So, you know, my last piece was more like what happens if I put myself into a traditional straight play? My piece, Fetch Clay McMahon. Again, it changed, but it was like and before that it was more like I was trying to innovate structure with hip hop theater. I was trying to innovate structure. So it's just kind of like part of my exploration. My next idea is what happens if I put myself inside a Tyler Perry play? That's what I want to know. Because, you know, yeah, like, you know, not a Tyler Perry play, but me inside a Tyler Perry play.
Mm-hmm.
How would that change it? Because there's a certain access, particularly with the Black community, that those works have. And yet, you know, some people would say that maybe the craft is not all there. So how could I bring the craft of Aristotelian drama into a Tyler Perry structure? So I've been thinking about that a lot, too. So we'll see how that goes. I don't know.
When you run up against the limitations that are inherent in the conventions of any form, like musical theater, there are certain things. I mean, you can certainly stretch the boundaries, but there are things that are sort of done and not done.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find those creatively useful in the way that, like, writing a haiku is really limiting, but it also forces you to think in different ways?
Yeah, I think so. I think through limitation, I tell this to my students at SMU all the time, through limitations brings great creativity. And if you have a completely open canvas, there's nothing wrong with that, but oftentimes the great creativity will come when you have some, not complete limitation, but, you know, some limitation. You can only draw within this 8x12 box, or you have to do this. I think great creative freedoms and innovation occur within that. So, yeah, I definitely think that. And then you push on it, and sometimes you can flip it and change it and then alter the whole genre. I mean, that's really, really can be really exciting, too. But yes, some limitation is good. It might be sometimes limitation in budget. You know, you might say, look, you've exhausted the costume budget, or you can't have this, so how do you change it? So I think that tension actually is healthy. Too much limitation can be stifling, but too much freedom, you know, you can have all the money in your world to do stuff. Sometimes I think that actually can kind of flatten out some innovations. Yeah.
Well, you have moved to Dallas. Mm-hmm. For now, this is your home, and mm-hmm. you are working here and producing here. Mm-hmm. But you also have, like, institutional support. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're living large, but, you've got a lot behind
I'm
you.
Doing okay, yeah.
What about for other artists? What will it take to get other people who are creating new works, not simply, and I don't want to take anything away from people who just perform works, but mm-hmm. people who are really innovating things, what does it take to bring them to a place like North Texas and convince them that it's worth the time and effort to pick up and come here?
Well, I think there needs to be a combination, quite frankly. One is attracting people from outside of North Texas, but the other thing is to cultivate and support the amazing, talented, fresh voices that are here that have maybe not, you know, if you're a playwright here and you're talented, but you don't get an opportunity to do a lot of productions or you don't get an opportunity to get a grant to go to some writing retreat, you're not going to necessarily grow as an artist. You know what I mean? So I feel like there's a lot of resources here and there's a lot of energy to bring people in. But I also feel like, in addition, I really applaud like Taka and some of the other people who are supporting local playwrights, because that's what creates a vibrant scene. And that's actually what attracts more and more people from New York, Chicago, London to come to a place. It's not just that you're flying people in, but it's like you have people homegrown from there. And then you have like, what is the Dallas theater vibe? What is the, you know what I mean? Like there's a Chicago theater energy. What is the mm-hmm. Dallas theater energy? I don't think we've articulated that fully yet as Dallas artists. Even though there's a great history of theater here, it is not like this is the Dallas playwright voice. This is the Dallas director voice. So I think that would be the next step. So you have playwrights here being supported and theater artists coming from outside. So it's happening, but I think that would be the next move with that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak on the phone with Virgil in Dallas. Hey, Virgil.
How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm going back to a comment that he made earlier when you was talking about that the opportunities are not evenly dispersed, where he said it's only in the, especially in the African-American community, where it's extraordinary mm-hmm. or celebrated, whereas in the other community, the larger white community, it's the average person who will still get a chance to get ahead, whereas you have to be, if you're a minority, you just have to have a Herculean effort just to get your foot in the door. So my question to him is this: how do we speak to those people who are just average, who are just trying to get to where they can have, but they are really not going to be able to get that because they're just not white? So how do we celebrate them and encourage them with your craft to keep going?
Yeah, and let me say this too, because I appreciate your comment. Let me say this, like, everyone is very special. So I don't mean to necessarily suggest that like some people are more special than other people, but what has really happened, and this is actually the challenge, is that 50, 60 years ago, African-Americans by and large lived together in the community. You had poor people, you had wealthy African-Americans, you had middle class. And so there were great challenges with that because it was the institution of Jim Crow. But there was also an opportunity there because you'd have more access to the quote unquote extraordinary artists, doctors, dentists, you know, if not on your block, then, you know, in the community. And so now what's happened is, you know, people want to have a better life, you know, a better house, better public education. That's understandable. But a lot of times those so-called extraordinary people have left the community. And so that's a real tricky thing, you know. So how do you balance that? I found that I've had a hard time negotiating that in my own life, you know, like, what does that mean if I'm living in this neighborhood and I'm not in the community? And so I think the point is that everyone needs to try to do their part. I'm talking specifically to the African-American community. And so, like, if you live in the community, how do you better that community? If you don't live in the community, how are you still plugged in that community? Are you doing workshops for that community? Are you still regularly connected? And so that's kind of what I try to do. My work is still very much, you know, my mother and my father were community activists, and I still very much look at myself as a community activist through my art, you know, and that sometimes means, you know, working with young folks in South Dallas. That sometimes means taking my daughter over there. I don't live in South Dallas, you know what I mean? But it's about trying to do your part. And maybe one day I will live in South Dallas, you know, if I buy a house. I haven't bought a house yet in Dallas, but maybe I will. But I think that's what it is, you know. Where it's a long reform, you know, there's been people like Frederick Douglass and, you know, even with women's rights, Susan B. Anthony, that was a long time ago. We're still trying to work for gender equity, you know, so it takes time. But everyone has to kind of do their part, and then we will progress. It's like, Chris, where you said that hope and that faith will come in. We will progress, and we are progressing. But it's like everyone has to do their part and be mindful of lending a hand and lifting someone else up in the community as best you can.
That's got to be especially challenging, though, for the generation of, we'll just talk about African Americans here, who are the first generation to sort of achieve the middle class and get some comfort. Like, at some point, you know, you're working for your own family, you're trying to just get stuff done. It's hard to have the extra time and energy and resources to turn back around to the community. Are there ways that people can sort of come together to do these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are formal ways and informal ways. I mean, yeah, I mean, on one level, you're working really hard, you're trying to support your family, but how do you stay plugged in? I mean, that could mean going into a cultural center and being active and helping to support donating. Or it could be just like, you know, when you drive down the street or you take out the trash, you see a young kid, you strike up a conversation. Mm-hmm. Those things can have huge impact. It doesn't have to be just that you have to spend all your time on that. It's just about how you move into your life, you know? And that's the same thing with other cultures, with whites, Latinos, Asians, you know, how do you help bring equity? You know, I work at SMU, and so, you know, I feel like a lot of the students that I work with at SMU are going to be, some of them, you know, no matter what ethnicity, are the leaders of tomorrow, particularly in this area. And so I'm like, just be mindful of that with your hiring practices. Be mindful of that with your recruiting techniques. How are you finding people that, so it's equitable to all cultures, you know? So you can still do your work and support your family and do your career, but being mindful of that and helping out where you can. That's what I mean. For some people, it is about, okay, I'm going to start this theater, this cultural center that's going to be a gathering space. And so their whole mission is about that. But even those that are like, okay, I want to be a doctor, I don't necessarily want to be a cultural activist, but even in your practice, you can do things because all of those institutions, the arts, education, the hospitals, medical, they all are inequitable, you know what I mean, to some level. And there are a lot of good people doing great things in there, but it comes from a history, you know, in United States and in North Texas. And so we need to rectify that history. We need to take all the beautiful things that happened in the past and continue those things. And the things that our ancestors and elders did that weren't so beautiful, we need to reform that big time.
Is the American dream a myth?
Oh, boy, that's a deep question. That's a deep question. Is it a myth? I think there's truth to the American dream. I really do. But at what cost and at what price? And that's what this piece explores. I feel like, without giving it away, I think that you can attain the American dream. You know, I feel like some in my family have attained it, some have not, but it's been a cost no matter what. And I feel like, particularly with African Americans, you have two things going. You have the outside obstacles to attaining the American dream that we talked about, racism and that kind of stuff. But then you also have the inner thing, too, because through the years, there's been a certain amount of trauma built up. So sometimes there is a self-destructive nature that rears its head in the community with some people. You know what I mean?
Like, so, trauma as a meme from generation to generation.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, for example, you know, there's been things I've seen growing up where, you know, maybe 100 years ago it was, you know, an overseer or a lynch mob. And now I've seen certain things. I don't want to, like, you know, say too many violent things, but I've seen certain things growing up as a boy that is like one black man doing something to another black man that really resembles what a lynch mob or what an overseer would do. And it's kind of like taking on this, you know what I mean? And it's this trauma that has not been fully rectified in the community. You know what I mean? You know, we came out of slavery, out of Jim Crow. There were no therapy sessions. You know what I mean? There was no, but you're talking about hundreds of years of mental and physical abuse. And so some of us are trying to do that. But I think that's the challenge. It's not just the exterior, it's the interior. And actually, I think Stagg Lee deals with both of those. You see the exterior oppression, but you also see the inner oppressions, the inner trauma, and how we, you know what I mean? People who are abused and oppressed, how they then sometimes, some people self-perpetuate that on other people. And so I think there's a lot of healing to be done. There's a lot of people working to heal the community. There's a lot of people in the community that are healing. So it's something that's progressing, but I don't think it's necessarily an overnight situation.
Playwright and performer Will Power wrote the book and lyrics for the musical Stagger Lee. The show made its debut at Dallas Theater Center and continues there through Sunday, February 15th. You can check out Jerome Weeks' special multimedia exploration of the show and its development at artandseek.org/Stagger Lee. Will, it has been such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.